everyone, and welcome to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a great big speculative fiction nerd.
So this week, we're having a bit of a podcast adventure. We're actually podcasting together live for the very first time, I think, ever, episode 21.
This is the very first time I've met Catherine in person.
That is a lie. So clearly, John is not part of the hive mind, because today we're talking about the Apple TV series Pluribus. Specifically, we're going to focus on episode 1, which is titled We as Us, and episode 8, which is titled Charm Offensive. So Pluribus is a series about an alien virus that's been transmitted to Earth via a radio signal that appears to infect all but a handful of the world's 8 billion people. These others appear to be all linked together in a hive mind and seem blissfully happy at all times. Their goal is to bring those who are immune into the fold so the world can work as one single unit.
14 months ago, astronomers discovered a radio signal from 600 light years away. There's no telling how long it's been repeating, maybe throughout all of human existence. This signal, it's made up of four tones representing guanine, uracil, adenine, and cytosine. It's a recipe, it turns out, for a nucleotide sequence, RNA. Scientists have created this sequence in a lab. It is not a living thing, per se. It is more akin to a virus, though it's not that exactly either. It's kind of a psychic glue capable of binding us all together.
One of the survivors, Carol Sturka, makes it her goal to save the world, but is met with hostility from the other survivors. She's ostracized and isolated, and eventually falls for one of the others to ease her loneliness. When she realizes they are all still actively working to assimilate her, she abandons them, using an atom bomb as leverage to keep them away. So that's kind of the plot of Pluribus, this new series that came out last fall on Apple TV. I convinced John to watch it. John, what did you think of the show?
I really enjoyed it. And the way I watched it, I think, was a little bit strange, because you told me about it after you had watched it. And then what I did is I went to Apple TV, I put it on, and I watched just until the point where they got the alien message and they were all together in the VLA. And I was thinking, you know what? I'll finish this later. I know this story. And then I came back about a month ago and started going from there, and it took a turn.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Yeah, the opening really reminded me of Contact, which we covered last season on the pod. Same setting at the VLA. They're getting a weird alien signal from outer space that has clearly the signs of an intelligence behind it. So I was definitely getting Contact vibes there. But yes, you're right. It's not Contact at all. I'm not really sure how to classify this show, but I like that. I like something new, something different that we haven't seen before.
100%. And it combines together so many different things, right? Like, you see that little bit from Contact. You see Vince Gilligan's history with the X-Files. And it's just such an unusual mishmash. And it feels like it shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah, yeah. I know there have been some criticisms of this series, but no, I think it's very intelligent and has a lot of interesting ideas to really gives you something to chew on at the end of every episode. So yes, I watched this because of my love for the X-Files, and in particular, the writer Vince Gilligan, who is the executive producer of this show. It was his brainchild. I actually never watched his other shows, though, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, which perhaps makes me a bad fan. But I don't know, something about them just didn't click with me. Maybe the violence, there was no sci-fi element to it. So when I heard he was doing this and it had more of that sci-fi bit to it, I was really excited. And I did really enjoy this series.
I have to say the same. I too found Breaking Bad to be pretty dark. Never did watch Better Call Saul. Great to see the main character of those shows come back here, by which I mean Albuquerque.
Yes, yes. And of course, the great Rhea Seehorn, who Vince Gilligan wrote this show for her. I think he had originally intended for the main character to be a man, but in working with her on Better Call Saul, decided he wanted to give her a platform. And I believe she already won an award for her work on this show. And she is quite excellent, I think, in this role of Carol Sturka.
It is interesting, isn't it, I think, with this show, that the idea didn't come from science fiction. The idea came from, you have a situation where everybody is just remarkably nice to one person, like everyone else together. And that turned out to be boring in Vince Gilligan's mind. So he decided to, you know, add to that.
Yeah, I heard him talk about that on the official podcast, how there's no drama in happiness. Mm. So he had to add this element to make it more dramatic. But I definitely see hints of these ideas, even going back to the X-Files. There's an episode in season 7 called Je Souhaite, which is I wish in French, where people can make wishes for a genie, but everything kind of turns out sideways. Parts of that in this show. There's also another episode in season 8 called Roadrunners, which is like this weird cult that worships a slug, and they all kind of were blissfully happy about this slug the same way the hive mind seems to be blissfully happy about, I don't know, what they're blissfully happy about, life.
But don't worry, we're going to get to that, folks. Yeah. Definitely. And luckily, you know, we have something called hedonic adaptation as human beings. So it's very difficult for us to be very happy for long, to bring us back to the drama.
Right. And, you know, there's a surprising amount of science in here, too, which, you know, as a scientist, I was happy to see. A bit of a warning, neither John or I are biologists, and there is quite a bit of biology in these episodes, but I did consult with a biologist, so hopefully at least half of what we're saying is correct.
And it's never stopped us before.
It has never stopped us before. That is true. So should we dive into our science gripes?
Oh, absolutely. Let's get it going.
So what stood out to you, John, as being the most egregious error in Pluribus?
Well, I think there's a few things here. Definitely, there are things to do with disease transmission that we'll come back with. That is very fast, surprisingly fast. But the big thing that bothered me, but it didn't bother me that much, I was able to set this aside, was the idea that we've got a message coming from another star 640 light years away, written in our own genetic code, and it's tailored to us and nothing else on the planet, except maybe some rats.
Yeah.
So that bothered me, the idea. Like, it's a cool thing and it's neat, but it doesn't make a lot of sense, right?
Yeah, we learned this signal is coming from a star system that's over 600 light years away. So that means to send any signal at all, it will take at least 600 years. So it begs the question of how do these aliens, presumably aliens, know what our biology is like? How did they learn about that? Was it some sort of weird panspermia situation where, you know, some sentient alien being seeded all the planets in the local neighborhood? Although 600 light years is actually pretty far away, so they'd have to seed an awful lot of planets for us all to have the same biology. But even if they'd been observing us for like millions of years with telescopes, I still don't think they would have known the chemical formula for DNA or RNA, right? How would you figure that out?
I know, it's really, really hard. And when you think about these systems, there's no reason that it has to be a base four system to express life.
No, I talk about this in my astrobiology class. I mean, computer code is binary. You could think of having a genetic code that's just two biomolecules, or it could be six. And it certainly doesn't have to be the four particular nucleotides we use in our DNA and RNA. And even there, DNA and RNA have slightly different nucleotides, which
Indeed. They
actually point out, or Davis Taffler talks about later in episode one. They specifically made it an RNA virus. So how did they learn all that? It's not clear, and it's really hard to explain scientifically.
Yeah, that's a bit of a challenge, I have to say. But the other part of it, I think, is how this gets transmitted, because it's both fast and it's slow, right? It's fast when they start at the beginning of the show. And there's one point where one of the infected scientists that Ysamrid, they go and they kiss one of the guards, and he starts vibrating violently before the virus would even have the chance to get to his brain. And apparently he only needs a very few number of it. They don't need to replicate in his body at all. So this lightning fast kind of thing that's going on. And then later on, there's this synchronization across all of the Earth, as if there's been, you know, something that's latent that's then released. Did you think this had to do with the contrails, by the way?
Yes, that is my hypothesis.
Okay.
That they were transmitting it person to person through kissing, I guess. And then to spread it more widely, they were just dumping this virus out of airplanes, because Carol and Helen look up outside the bar and see a couple of airplanes fly past.
That's right.
with obvious contrails. And so my guess was that was how they were implying the virus was being transmitted more globally.
Yes, the famous chemtrail conspiracy being used there.
Although I do not think that would be a good mechanism for transmitting the virus, right? I mean, COVID is famously airborne virus, but if the air quality is good enough, like standing outside, you've got a really low chance of catching it. So like, unless you trap everyone in a really poorly ventilated room with this virus, I just don't see it transmitting that quickly and that far.
Oh yeah, especially if you're doing it from aircraft. And because they have contrails, you can see that condensation of the water vapor, they're probably up in the stratosphere.
Which
It doesn't mix with the troposphere easily.
Oh, right, fair.
So
fair,
the idea that you could see the contrails and then feel the effect of the virus, it takes too long from an atmospheric science perspective to get it down from that high up.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah. And then, so I also looked up some incubation times for different viruses, and the shortest ones appear to be on the order of like half a day. So the common cold has an incubation time of 12 hours to 3 days. Influenza is 1 to 4 days. Norovirus, 12 to 2 days. So there are a couple viruses that act quickly, but as John said, it takes time to replicate in your body and cause symptoms. And this virus, quoting marks, appears to be more neurologic, right? It's affecting their brains. And those diseases, like rabies, for example, take a much longer time to infect people. Rabies is at least 2 weeks and up to 6 months. So it just was hard to believe that these people would get infected so quickly.
Yeah, it's difficult to cross that barrier into the brain. It takes time for these things to happen. So, you know, it's fun to watch, 100%.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, realistic, not so much.
Yeah, very dramatic. I mean, the first episode is probably the most tense of all 9 episodes. It is quite a scary story in some respects, but I appreciate. So that I'm complaining.
Especially when watched in double speed.
Yeah, why did you watch it in double speed?
So I had watched the whole series on regular speed back about a month ago, but we always like to prepare, dear listener, before we get on the air here with you. And so the other night, I was a little bit pressed for time, but I do my research. That's just who I am. So I turned everything up to double speed, and I watched it that way, and oh, wow, is that creepy.
And then you didn't sleep. Yeah, I had my 7-year-old son watch the first episode with me, and he keeps like bringing it up in conversation. He's like, "What's happening to those people? What's going on?
Are they okay?
Are they okay?" So, okay, well, let's get back to this virus. So they specifically say it's a lysogenic virus, which was not a term I'm familiar with. And honestly, even after researching it, I still don't entirely understand what they meant by this. So I turned to some biologist friends. So Dr. Anne Revel, friend of the pod, who was on our Jurassic Park episode earlier this season, she actually asked a virologist friend of hers, and that friend said that you typically don't use that term unless you're talking about a virus that affects bacteria. So that doesn't make a ton of sense. In general, the idea of lysogeny, if I'm saying that correctly, is that the virus is sort of latent within the host system. So herpes, shingles, HIV, these are often kind of in the lysogenic cycle, but they can pop up again and cause flare-ups in the lytic cycle. So there's kind of like two cycles of a virus's life. But this virus does not seem latent. It's not infecting a bacteria. So I don't know why they use that particular term to describe it. Yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, not really. Like the best I can figure from reading the Wikipedia article on this is the dormant latent phase where you're not destroying cells is that lysogenic phase. But in order to replicate, you need to go through that lytic phase.
Yeah.
So the best I could figure is where they talk about this virus as just being a vector for what's happening and that it doesn't actually hurt the people. It just brings out whatever is latent inside of them. Maybe that's what they're going for, or maybe it's just technobabble.
It might be technobabble. Yeah, yeah. Although I did think it was interesting because they very obviously show them spreading this virus on agar plates. Mm. And agar plates are normally used for bacteria, not for viruses. Because viruses require living tissue culture. They can only reproduce inside living cells. So you typically wouldn't put a virus on an agar plate. So, but maybe this is some sort of, I don't know, some bacterial virus, and then the bacteria infects humans. I think I'm taking this like way too far. And I, as you said, I don't think the writers thought this far either. Maybe it was just a technobabble. But if it is just a virus, you wouldn't use agar to distribute it.
Yeah, like you say, they don't grow on their own. And even though you're probably going to get some cheek cells on the agar, cheek cells don't replicate in agar.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe this does suggest that it is a bacterial virus and then the bacteria infect the humans. But even then, they would not operate that quickly.
So if you're keeping score, dear listeners, we are uncertain about the message to build the virus. We are uncertain about the transmission of the virus. Why don't we talk about how uncertain we are about what the virus actually does?
Right. Are you talking about how like they can share their memories and thoughts and
talk
to each other telepathically?
Unconscious like radio, right?
Unconscious like radio. I will give the series props for not really trying to explain it because it is unexplainable. Carol and Zosia have a conversation in episode 8 where Zosia attempts to explain it, not very well, but she says, we don't really know how it works, something to do with the body's electromagnetic field, our natural electric charge, so to speak. And Carol says, so like radio? Sort of. Our communication is unconscious, like breathing. There's still a lot we don't really understand. This doesn't make any sense either. Humans do not transmit radio waves. The only electric charge we have, you would have to be touching another person to interact with it. Any electromagnetic radiation we do transmit is thermal, right? If you've ever had those night vision goggles and you can see people walking around, we transmit at those wavelengths, not at radio wavelengths. So I don't see an obvious way for people to use their electromagnetic field to talk to each other telepathically.
And the idea that kind of takes away your free will and links you in a network, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. There are other organisms that can actually have that electroreceptive sense, for instance. So, you know, sharks are like this and some other fish. They have an organ called the ampullae of Lorenzini, which allows them to detect the electrical field of other organisms, mainly so that they can eat them. But you've got a couple of these types of devices or specialized organs that other animals have. You have magnetoreception as well. And none of these seem to link together organisms into this kind of hive mind. So when you had that quote that you just read out from Zosia, that made me more confused, I have to say. The idea that it's unconscious, but it's compelling. It's strange.
Yeah, you'd rather they just didn't even attempt to explain it, perhaps?
Maybe. I enjoy the suspension of disbelief in this one, but it's something where I feel like every time I look at it a little bit closer, I get more and more worried about like the science side.
Yeah, no, certainly there's some big gaps in the science here. I think you could argue they were going for that sort of swarm intelligence that insects have, but that's not a conscious thing. That's just driven by pheromones, essentially. So it's their biological imperative, as Zosia calls it. But the ants aren't conscious. They don't know why they're doing what they're doing. Whereas every hive mind member seems to have like knowledge of the bigger plan and the fact that they're trying to assimilate Carol and the others who are not affected by this virus. Whereas the ants are just kind of doing what they do based on chemical signaling.
Yeah, like all of the information is in the air there. I think if we had a computer scientist or an information scientist, the kinds of messaging that would have to happen, the information flow, the volume of information mm-hmm. that would have to flow so that people had access to this kind of information, especially when they're very separated from one another.
Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
There's a lot there. Yeah.
We touched on this a little bit last season in our Battlestar Galactica episode. We were talking about how easy it would be for the Cylons to upload their memories to the resurrection ship. And it's
kind of
the same idea here. In that episode, I found some Reddit article that estimated that the human brain stores something like 100 terabytes. And so if you use like typical internet upload speeds, you know, it would take probably at least a couple hours to upload one person's memories, right? And so multiply that by, you know, 8 billion. That would take a while. And they seem to be communicating, if not instantaneously, nearly there.
And it's information rich, right? Because they can bring in muscle memory. They can bring in deep knowledge that needs to be trained in the sense that the show alleges that any member of the hive mind can use the expertise of any other member of the hive mind.
Right. Yeah, and even muscle memory. When they're playing croquet, Zosia said, you know, as an individual, Zosia had never played croquet, and yet she's kicking Carol's butt there. You suck, Carol.
Oh, I love that. Along with like all the Chirons or Chirons.
Yeah. No, it's some pretty clever comedy here. So broad strokes, I think there's a lot wrong with the scientific concept of pluribus, but honestly, there are a lot of details they got right. So perhaps we should mosey on over to Science Shine now?
Sure, let's go ahead and do that. We'll leave the moralizing maybe for the end.
Sounds good.
All right, welcome back. So despite the fact that you heard us enumerate all of our challenges with this show, there are some really neat things that they get to play around with and they get right. So join us for the Science Shine. So Catherine, what was your favorite shining moment for them?
Well, let's start from the top. As I said, I really love that opening scene at the Very Large Array, or the VLA, in New Mexico. I can see why they used it if they are filming in Albuquerque. It's actually not that far away. It's in Socorro, New Mexico. And that is a real telescope, as we talked about in Contact. And apparently most of the extras in the trailer were folks who actually work there. They had a technical advisor from the VLA. And yeah, and so that all checks out. I love to see all the nerdy stuff. They did seem like real scientists. Excitedly talking about this very interesting signal. And again, like Contact, it seemed like it was extraterrestrial, right? It had this repetition every 78 seconds. It had this weird pulse width modulation that's pretty uncommon for anything you'd see on Earth. They were looking for local sources to rule out, oh, it must be the Forest Service. I hate those chatty Cathys talking about trees. You know, so they were doing the sorts of things a radio astronomer would do to rule out contamination from the Earth. Because you don't want to say it's aliens before you rule out all the obvious things first. So they were doing all the right things. It looked realistic. And the pulse width modulation they talk about is a way you could theoretically send a signal from one intelligence to another. Basically, you're just changing the signal between a high and a low state. So it kind of looks like, oh, what are they called?
Square wave?
Yeah, square wave, sawtooth pattern. And so this would kind of tell the person who's receiving it, hey, we know what we're doing. We're transmitting information. And as the scientist says, it's like Morse code in a way. Yes, it is sort of like Morse code because you can vary the width and the height of these waves. So it can kind of be like dit, 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 da, you know, da, da, da for SOS or whatnot. So I thought that was realistic. And then as soon as the signal becomes clear, it's base four. As soon as they said this, I'm like, oh, it's going to be DNA. And I was almost right. As we said, RNA and DNA are very similar. So yeah, I think that all checks out. What did you think of that first scene?
Well, I particularly love the point where the scientist puts the pieces together.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out, you know, oh, is it cryptography because it's a, you know, a base four? And it happens while he's doing something completely different. He's just, you know,
right,
catching a baseball.
Yeah.
And so often for us scientists, you know, these insights, they come to us in the strangest places.
Absolutely. Shower thoughts for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. So I love that element was in there. You really got the feeling that these were real scientists.
Yeah. And as I said, a lot of those people were real scientists. I don't think that actor was, but all the extras were.
It was done well, right? And I think the mechanics of science that were not so much in service to the plot have this kind of authenticity to them. So if you move on from the VLA and go to USAMRIID, where they're actually in the process of synthesizing this virus, and this is where it kind of gets out and into the human population, you see a lot of bits and pieces that make good sense. So USAMRIID is a real place. It's where you would want to go to do biosafety level 4 stuff in the United States. My childhood, I enjoyed a very frightening book called The Hot Zone by Richard Preston, which talks about Ebola. I had a strange childhood, what can I say? It was neat to see this particular facility and the kinds of suits that they wore and the kind of protocols that they had. They even went for authenticity in how they operated with their protocols rather than what the executive producer, the creator, Vince Gilligan, wanted to do. Like, he wanted to have this sort of, you know, creepy moment of infection with one person in the lab, but their science advisors point out, you don't do that. You always have to have at least two people, and so they did. But he found a way to make it creepy anyway.
Oh yeah, it was still really creepy. By the way, for those of you who don't understand what John is saying, USAMRIID is an acronym for United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. That is quite a mouthful.
You're saying that not everybody listening to this read The Hot Zone when they were 12?
I mean, not everyone talking currently has read The Hot Zone. So this was new to me. I didn't even know if it existed. I had to look it up on Wikipedia, although I did clock the Maryland state flag in the background. I lived in Maryland for several years, and I always noticed this flag because it looks kind of like an ambulance ran into a taxi cab. It's just this mash of colors. And it is, in fact, in Maryland, as so many federal labs are. But yeah, so again, I reached out to friend of the pod, Dr. Ann Revel, who actually works with mice in her research. So I was like, perfect. She will know whether this is accurate or not. And she was pretty happy with the scene. The rats we see housed in those cage racks, that's typically how you house rats. And you'd probably want to keep them separated because they've been infected with some crazy virus. So you don't want them interacting. She also noticed that the lab scene where they're working on synthesizing this virus seemed pretty accurate with the instruments they were using. I was also very very pleased to see that they had a balanced centrifuge, which is something everyone complained about for Project Hail Mary. There's a scene in Project Hail Mary where they have a very unbalanced centrifuge, which is not something any scientist would do, but they did that correctly here. Again, the attention to detail was great. They recruited extras who had experience working in labs, so it made the whole scene more realistic. They really did pay attention to all the little details, even though the big ideas are kind of wrong. I like that they incorporated all these correct small details.
I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Because when we see people nitpicking this stuff on the internet, they're often going after the small details, like the centrifuge. And we talked about it last week, you know, on Project Hail Mary. It doesn't matter, folks. And even if it is, you only have the samples on one side, as long as there's enough mass in that thing, it doesn't matter. But the bigger stuff are fun to play with, too. And it is always nice when you see that commit down at the low level. And I think you actually had some experience with gassing rats yourself.
I do. Yeah, I'm sorry, mice from 1998. Rest in peace. So when the two scientists are talking about how they're going to euthanize the rats, the female scientist, I think her name was Jen, says something like, are we going to gas them or use the cardiac stick? And she's like, oh, I really don't want to gas them. I'm going to use the cardiac stick. So what they meant by those two things, so gassing them. And so very commonly, mice and rats are euthanized by suffocating them in CO2, which is just about as horrible as you can imagine. And so in the summer of 1998, I actually got a high school internship with the Heart and Stroke Foundation of British Columbia and worked at a hospital in downtown Vancouver. And I was working with a PhD student, and she was studying a type of heart infection, myocarditis. And so they were infecting these mice with these virus, I guess not unlike pleuribus. And then you would euthanize them and analyze their hearts, right? I didn't feel so bad about euthanizing the sick rats because they were probably going to die anyways. But you know, you knew there were healthy controls in there too, and that was kind of devastating. Because yeah, I literally just stuck the mouse. It was a mouse in this case, into a Tupperware jar, stuck in a hose of CO2, and then you could see them like suffocating to death. It's pretty horrible. But this is very common technique. This is how Anne euthanizes the mice that she works with. I guess you want a two-pronged system. So you want your primary method, which is the suffocation, and then a backup method. So she suffocates them and then snaps their spinal cord. That's apparently pretty common amongst lab facilities. I then talked to my sister, who's a vet tech, and she says they use this cardiac stick, which is where you just inject, like you basically do lethal injection, but right into their heart. And I guess this is easier when you can't do IV because their veins are so tiny. But I get the impression you wouldn't do that in a lab. I think you'd need more specialized equipment to do that. So I wasn't quite sure why they brought it up in this scene. It, like Anne said, mostly they do suffocation. Now, John, you were worried about why they were using CO2 and not a more humane method like nitrogen.
Well, this is interesting because we do a lot of sci-fi, obviously, in this channel here. And outside of the pod, Catherine and I both read a fair bit of sci-fi. And the more realistic stuff, you end up with astronauts who are a long way from help. And sometimes they don't want to wait around. So it's interesting, this idea of using gas as a means to induce death. And we know from like Apollo 13 and some of these other works that carbon dioxide, when that builds up in your blood, you get this this suffocation feeling that encourages you to take more breaths. It's more the buildup of carbon dioxide than the lack of oxygen that gives you that feeling. In a lot of the science fiction that you see out there, they're like, you know, well, let's not use carbon dioxide, let's use nitrogen. And that's much more humane, allegedly. Although there is one U.S. state that has started using this as a way to carry out death penalty cases. And it sounds like it is not particularly humane.
Yikes. Yeah, I found a couple of articles, too, about switching from CO2 to N2 in the euthanization of lab animals. But I think they use CO2. From what I could read, it's cheaper than nitrogen. And apparently it works as an anesthetic in high concentrations. So the idea is, okay, well, you're going to knock them out before they suffocate. Whereas with nitrogen, it might take longer to die. So, you know, I think it's something people are actively studying. But for now, it is very, very common to gas mice and rats in a lab. The heart stick, the cardiac stick, is, like I said, I think that's common in veterinary practice, but not so much in the labs.
Yeah, I think for me here, it's just having seen that a couple times in a couple different pieces, I wanted to dive into that a little bit. And it looks like it doesn't work as well in nitrogen as you know, other science fiction authors think it does.
Yeah. I mean, in general, it's just horrible to yes, have to euthanize yes. animals. You know, it helps us understand, I guess, I don't know. I'm a vegetarian, so I especially feel bad about this, but I guess you can rationalize it away by saying we're going to learn more about helping humans.
Fortunately, the rat in Pluribus did not die.
That's right. I guess he just scampered away. The happiest rat on earth.
I know. And they even do the heart rate correctly, that kind of measurement.
Yeah. And, you know, like, how would you even tell if a rat was happy, right? So I posed this question again to Anne, and she said there are ways you can monitor their stress levels.
Oh, yeah. Cortisol.
No. Just by, like, observing their behavior, basically. So looking how much they groom themselves, how much they move around their cage. So she said that's how she would try to assess whether or not they were stressed. There's even certain mazes you can put them through to see how well they can remember things. If they're more stressed, they'll remember less well than if they're happy.
Gotcha.
So yeah, there are some behavioral techniques you can implement to find a happy rat versus a not so happy rat.
Very neat.
So one other thing I want to bring up, because I thought this was extremely clever on Carol's part. When, you know, everyone starts shaking and falling over and she's desperate to get Helen some help, she does something very clever, and she takes this sandwich board from the bar, the restaurant, and uses it to lever her into the truck, right? Because lifting up a, I don't know, 150-pound woman is not the easiest thing if you too are a 150-pound woman. But if you can use a lever, it's actually a simple design to use a very small force over a large distance. So I thought this was kind of a cool use of torque in order to get Helen into the truck.
And it's impressive that she's able to keep her wits about her while everyone else is just falling entirely to pieces.
Well, I mean, they've been affected. She hasn't.
Oh, absolutely. But I can imagine many people in this kind of situation would just shut down. So she's able to still think her way through these problems.
Yeah. I don't know. There's this weird survival instinct that kind of comes out when you're in really stressful circumstances. So it was good to see Carol rise to the occasion and able to reason out these sorts of things. So anyways, hooray for torque.
Oh, indeed. And we have some neat things, I think, about Kepler-22b. We have a visual telescope that actually could see it. That's shown in the Charm Offensive episode. So that's quite nice. I know you did the calculation here. Do you want to talk about absolute magnitude or?
Yeah. So in that scene, it's a beautiful scene. It's not actually an observatory. It's just some random place in Albuquerque that was near to where they were filming. It was a beautiful location. So props to them for finding it. But what they've done is they've put this specific type of telescope. It's called a Dobsonian telescope, and they've set it up correctly. So Carol's looking in the eyepiece at the top of the telescope, which is correct. And I was like, well, could we even see the star Kepler-22 with a telescope of that type? I guesstimated it was about a foot wide. And yeah, so it seems like a telescope that big could see a star this bright. So Kepler-22 has what's known as an apparent magnitude of 11.7. And a Dobsonian of this size could probably see a star down to about 15th magnitude. So what the heck does that mean? So apparent magnitude is a measure of the brightness of a star. It takes into account how bright the star is, how far away it is, if there's anything in between the Earth and the star that might remove some of the light. And it's kind of this weird logarithmic scale. The larger the number, the dimmer it is. So this is all reference to the star Vega, which you may know from our previous podcast on Contact. That's zero. So if you're 11.7, you're, 2.5 times 12, basically. I don't even know what that is. Hundreds of times less bright than Vega because it's this logarithmic scale. The moon, for reference, is -12.7. If it's very bright, you get negative numbers. And so, yeah, it's a faint star, but you could see it with a telescope of this size.
So if you're curious about Kepler-22b itself, so this is a place that is not that much like Earth. So we're talking about something 640 light years away. And it's a strange kind of planet, one that we call a super Earth, in the sense that it's bigger than the Earth, but it's smaller than the smallest gas giant planets. And as a result of that, it probably has more water. It probably has a thicker atmosphere. It's definitely less dense, but it contains more mass than the Earth does, about 9 times. So it is in the habitable zone. But you can imagine a planet like that would be very different from the Earth. It's very remarkable to me that they also have 4 base pair, you know, DNA going on in their blood. Yeah. But it's an interesting place. There are folks who believe that these kinds of super Earths are actually better places in the cosmos to find life than places like our own planet, that these places would protect the life that formed more easily than the Earth, which has definitely been subject to a lot of disasters that nearly wiped us off the face of the planet.
Although I saw a lot of people complain about this choice of a planet on social media because it is covered in an ocean or a gaseous layer. And so the obvious question is, where the heck would you put a radio telescope, right? Is it in orbit? There's no evidence that there's a large moon they could put a radio telescope on either. So how are they sending the signal?
Hey, we learned in the Abyss that if you're a water creature, you've got control of that.
Oh, yeah.
You just make a big dish out of, you know, moving water around. Or maybe this is where the Abyss aliens came from.
Oh, fair point. There That's how they knew. That's how they knew. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know exactly why they chose this planet. It is notable for being the first known transiting planet within the habitable zone of a sun-like star. And they found it on the third day of Kepler's scientific operations, which is pretty impressive. Kepler, I think we've talked about before, was a NASA mission. It was a telescope that was sent up to stare at nearby stars and faraway stars to look for tiny dips in their light curve that would indicate a planet was transiting in front of them. So this was the first kind of habitable planet for a sun-like star that they found with this mission. Hence the name Kepler-22.
Well, maybe this is the time where we have to actually grapple with the big question, which is the signal.
Yes.
So there's a quote in here. Imagine the power it took to send it. Megawatts, gigawatts, an antenna the size of Africa. And dear listener, we could not leave that be. And Catherine gave me a poke on this one to say, John, take a look at this, because I do a lot of stuff with radiation myself in my work. This is really kind of an interesting problem. And depending upon how you go about it, you can get different answers for this. So, of course, the first place I decided to go was that bastion of well-reasoned and considered discourse on the internet, Reddit. And Reddit, they have numbers and they don't say why. So they come up with huge, huge numbers for a signal that's directed just at us. They claim that you need somewhere between a terawatt and 1,000 terawatts of power. If it's a beacon, so something that goes off in all directions equally, what we would call isotropic, then you need far more power. You need like 100 billion watts, which is absolutely enormous. To give you an idea of the kinds of numbers that we're dealing with here, the current electrical consumption of the entire world is something like 27,000 terawatt hours in a year. So if you imagine that that's the same amount of power draw everywhere all the time, it averages out to about 3 terawatts. And I found it interesting that when you go and you actually do the calculation, you can get a number that's very much like that. So what I decided to do was to take Voyager 1, which is quite distant and is still able to communicate with the Earth, even though it is getting to be harder and harder to hear in quotey marks. And it's communicating with the VLA, which is exactly the array that we have in this particular show. So Voyager's transmitter has 23 watts of radio power. It's got a beam width that's half a degree wide. That, by the way, only gets you about 1 attawatt. So that's 1/1,000,000,000 of a watt by the time you get back to the VLA in New Mexico. So it's amazing what these things can do. Kepler-22b is a lot further away. So the signal needs to be a lot stronger. So if you had Voyager and you put it where Kepler-22b is, you would need to run about 3.5 terawatts through that dish in order to get the power home at the same power that we get now at the VLA. So far, so good. But there's a problem here. You're not likely to send a message across interstellar distances with a dish that's only a few meters across. So we can do better than that. If you use just one of the bigger dishes we have available today, like the one at Goldstone that you may recall from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that one's 70 meters across. It has a much more concentrated signal, or a point with more accuracy, more resolution than the Voyager disk. The beam width here, instead of being half a degree, is 0.004. And that gets that power down for a directed signal to just 19 gigawatts, which is much less. And Goldstone is not the size of Africa. So it turns out you can actually do a little bit better than that, but you still got to put a lot of power through it. The most powerful radio transmitter that we had of this style was Arecibo, 2.5 megawatts. So if you could do something like that and just simply make it about 8,000 times stronger, then you're off to the races. And sure is easier to send a message than it is to actually go there.
Yes, yes. I will note that we would never like physically make an antenna the size of Africa either. We can use something called interferometry to add the signal of a bunch of telescopes together. And actually there is something called very long baseline interferometry, or VBLI, which links radio telescopes all over Earth to make what's effectively a giant Earth-sized telescope. So again, even if you did need a telescope the size of Africa, which apparently you don't, you could do that with lots of little telescopes. But again, not sure how they did this on a water world without a moon. So unless they're weird abyss-like creatures who are cleverer than us.
Yeah, it's a challenge, isn't it? But I do enjoy this, right? Because there's another movie that comes to mind when I look at this one. Mm-hmm. And it's from quite a while back. Dear listeners, let us know on Blue Sky if you would like to see us review this one. It's one of Michael Crichton's first stories, The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Did they make a movie out of that?
They did.
Oh, okay.
They did. So with The Andromeda Strain, you have actual pathogens from space that come down to the Earth and start infecting people. And it's much more terrible than what you see in this particular show, Pluribus. So I thought it's interesting. There's a parallel there with it's pretty impractical to actually travel across the light years. Sending a message is still hard, but it's doable. So here we have infection from across the light years. Just neat.
Yep. Well, I think that wraps things up for the Science Shine, unless there's anything else you wanted to mention, any fun facts?
No, I think we can leave Soylent Green for now.
yeah, they eat people. Let's not dive into that. Okay, we'll move on now and wrap things up with our Of Its Time section. Okay, so Pluribus is a rather recent show. It was filmed from February to September 2024 and was released November 7th, 2025. You can actually see it being constructed on Google Earth if you ever want to bring that up. So this neighborhood that Carol lives in was constructed by the production team because they didn't want people descending on somebody's actual house and bothering them. I guess as happened with Walter White's house in Breaking Bad. So they just built a little fake neighborhood just outside of Albuquerque. And it's really cool. You can see it being constructed on Google Earth. It goes from just being like empty desert on May 30th in 2023. You can see it under construction by August 30th of that year. Then it comes back fully formed August 30th, 2024. And you can actually see Come Back, which Carol writes, I think at the end of episode 7, which you can see in episode 8 as well. It's a bit of a spoiler there. And then it's gone by March 30th, 2025. And it's just the neighborhood again. So it's kind of cool to see the whole set get constructed over time there in Albuquerque. So yeah, this is a show that was Vince Gilligan's brainchild. He came up with it, as John mentioned, this idea he had. I think he was filming Better Call Saul at the time and was going on a walk and came up with this idea of what was it like all of their wishes could come true, basically.
Exactly, yeah.
And came up with Pluribus after working with Ray Seahorn. The name, of course, refers to the unofficial model of America, E Pluribus Unum, a Latin phrase meaning out of many one, which is kind of, you know, appropriate for this show. And so they ran with that. I think it's a clever title. Yeah. Is there any, I have a lot of notes here. So where do you want to start, John?
Oh, there's a lot of bits and pieces that I feel like I think we've entered the period in TV for millennials where our ilk are writing stories and making shows, and we're seeing a lot of little callbacks. Like you mentioned the canned juice. Oh, I remember that so much.
That was a great scene. Because when you first see her pouring, it's lemonade, right?
Yes.
You think it's blood. Because I think we had just been in a scene with Manousos when he was bleeding. And then it's revealed to just be like cherry lemonade. And yeah, that brought me back to my childhood. All the frozen canned juice that my mother would make.
Oh, yes. Entertainingly, not long after this came out, Minute Maid, which was the big pioneer in this field, announced that they were getting out of the frozen canned juice. So end of an era, folks, for any of those still doing this.
Very sad. I guess Carol got the last one at Sprouts there. The hive found it for her.
It could be the hive doesn't drink this stuff, so maybe she's got lots.
Well, as we know, the hive drinks some very questionable beverages.
Indeed. It's not milk, folks.
And there was also a landline in her house. I was surprised to see a landline when everyone has cell phones these days. But thankfully, it was there so she could talk with Peter Bergman, a.k.a. Davis Taffler, Undersecretary of Agriculture. And I love seeing him. He is an actor who has famously played Jack Abbott on The Young and the Restless for decades, which was a show I watched religiously as a teenager.
Learning new stuff every day.
He was just perfect for that role. So I really enjoyed that role and glad that Carol was able to talk to him. You can actually call the number on the screen. It's a Washington, D.C. number. So of course I did. I think the text on the line has changed over time, but currently if you call it, it is May 2026 right now. It says, "Hi, Carol. Sorry we weren't around for a while. And you know, we need our space, but we're so happy to be back. If you need anything, please dial 0 and look out for a text from us." So anyways, I thought that was a cute detail.
Oh, yeah. I do love when they call her that they've changed the caller ID to actually refer to the others. And so many uses of that sort of thing, right? Like we talked about the Chiron on that particular video. There's Carol, you suck in the, you know, when they're playing croquet. And just those little call outs are just so delicious.
Yeah. They also have that card game I've never heard of called Spit, which appears to have originated in the 70s. I guess it's sort of like Speed. Have you ever played this?
No, I can't say I have.
I haven't either. But again, it's sort of a Gen X millennial sort of thing that seems realistic for Carol to have been playing as a child. So Zosia mentions that she originally comes from Poland. She mentions eating ice cream in Gdansk shortly after Poland opened up to the West. And that checks out too. I looked up the actress, Karolina Vidra, is the same age as us. So she would have been a child when Poland opened up in 1989. So that all jives. So I guess Pluribus is taking place in the present day, essentially.
Yeah, but did she sing in a children's choir?
Not an East German children's choir, unless she moved around a lot. We were confused, though, how she ended up in Morocco later on. When we first see Zosia, she's actually like almost in like tatters in Morocco. I hope we get some in season two, some background on how she ended up there. Like, did she move there? Was she on vacation? Was she kidnapped? Like, how did she end up there?
Yeah, this is why when she started talking about Poland, I was confused.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing, I mean, I'm certain they make this point subtly that it's because she looks like the character, right, in Carol's books.
Oh, that's exactly why. Yeah. They even gave her a wig so she'd look even more like the pirate lady.
Raban.
So a nice little call outs there to the Gen X elder millennial sort of generation. I also loved the first scene with Carol in it at Barnes & Noble. It was a real call out to fan culture. I guess it was actually specifically based on some experiences Vince Gilligan has had at conventions. There was one guy in particular, I guess his name was Craig, and he's like pointing at all these inaccuracies in her book. He's like, "A small but very crucial point. As a two-masted schooner, the Mercator would not possess a mizzenmast." So of course I had to nitpick his nitpick, and he turns out he's right. I didn't know this about boats, but apparently if you have two masts, it's a foremast and a mainmast, and the mizzenmast is typically the third mast. So anyways, I thought that was cute. I loved all the fans. It felt very relatable as somebody who was also an obsessive fan about various television shows. But John, you've written a book. You've done book signings like this before, haven't you? What's that like?
I have, and I've got to say, you get some real characters who come up and join that signing line. And, you know, all I can say is as an author, we really adore the people who want to dive into that and buy a copy. But yeah, you get interactions that you don't expect. And this was a good, I think, encapsulation of that. And some people have not read the book deeply at the time they're getting it signed. And some people really, really have.
Has anyone brought a sword to your book signing?
Not yet, but maybe for the next one.
All right. Life goals.
Indeed.
So yeah, I love that scene. I also thought the nerd scenes, as we talked about, were pretty realistic. There, you can see some stickers on the laptops at the VLA that were very in line with scientist culture. There was a NASA logo with nerd replacing the word NASA. There was a JWST sticker. So that was, I might have been just one of the scientists' own laptops. You know, it seemed very realistic. If you go to any scientific conference, half the laptops there will just be covered in nerdy stickers.
Oh, yeah. There's that interesting culture. And I think that there's something creative with science. It really intersects with a lot of art culture as well to see that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Just interesting.
There was a random comment by Helen that I had to look up because she talks about like powering through this book called Finnegan's Wake in grad school or something. And it's not a book I'd ever heard of before, but I guess it's known as one of the most difficult works in literature, written by Irish writer James Joyce. He published it in installments starting in 1924. And it was only finally released in 1939. And I guess what makes it so difficult is that even though it's technically written in English, he came up with his own like distinctive idiom and he uses that throughout the book. And everyone just like has no idea how to read it. People are baffled by it and just do not enjoy reading it. So although perhaps it was telling that Helen was comparing this book to Carroll's more serious book, as we later learned, she didn't think it was very good after all.
No, but it's one of those that I guess gets a lot of credit for, you know, being high art, right? Mm. I will say I do find James Joyce in general a bit of a difficult read. I can't say that I have tried Finnegan's Wake, but Ulysses was not the most fun read I have ever had, with apologies to the English majors out there.
Well, even Helen, who might have been an English major, did not seem very inspired to read it. So we have, yeah, anyways, no love for Finnegan's Wake here.
One thing that we don't really have a good category for is, I think, some of the morality that this series struggles with. And one thing that is really fascinating is the fact that the characters are not really super relatable. Like the hive mind is a little bit other. And Carroll is set up like even before Zero Hour as being a real misanthrope, you know, someone who's not a big fan of other people, who doesn't always treat them well. Even the people she cares about, she doesn't treat particularly well. They go out of their way to picking examples of that.
Yeah, yeah. Although we get some hints throughout the series for perhaps why she is so distrustful. So I guess we haven't mentioned this yet, but of its time, it is incredibly rare to see a gay woman as a lead character in a television show. And I guess it's good that we're only just bringing it up now. We just kind of took it for granted. It wasn't a big deal. But this is actually a big part of her background. Throughout the show, it becomes clear that her mother sent her to conversion therapy, quoting marks, when she was younger, which is when they try to like drill the gay out of you. I don't know the details, perhaps thankfully, of this process, but clearly I think it traumatized her, especially now that the others are trying to convert her again into something she does not want to be. So I think it's triggering a lot of that trauma. She has a lot of trust issues, probably because of this background. She does not seem close with her family. Like Helen is the only one she seems to trust. And then she dies, right? And she's left all alone.
Yeah. I feel like a number of the folks that are unable to make that transition. So we have the 11 people who are left in the world. And then you have the people who were not successful in moving over. Interestingly, most of the senior U.S. government was not able to make that transition. Hence why we have someone from the Young and the Restless in the USDA, right? You know, it makes you wonder how that glue actually works.
Well, it's not just that they weren't able to make the transition. I think a lot of people just died in accidents during the joining.
Oh, yeah.
Like a full billion people died during the joining.
Yes, yes. And I can imagine that you have random things going on. Like, for instance, back to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, we noticed at least the power in the plane doesn't go off.
Right.
But in this one, you know, if your pilots are, you know, vibrating, maybe that's not great.
Right. I mean, there'd be plane crashes, car crashes. Helen just falls over. I mean, I think that's probably what killed her, was just the head trauma.
Yeah, it's just falling right on that concrete pad.
Right. So, I mean, I think there were many accidents that happened and just killed a lot of people during the joining.
Oh, yeah. But it does make you wonder a little bit. And one thing that I really see coming through here is it strikes me that every character in this show is dealing with some kind of loneliness or isolation. Mm-hmm. And even the hive, the others, they seem superficially happy, but they don't seem complete to me, right? That there seems to be, you know, like something they're hungering for that they can't quite put their finger on.
Well, yeah, they're so excited when Carroll says she's going to write a new novel.
Exactly.
And I mean, obviously, a lot of people have talked about the allegory between Pluribus and generative AI. The hive kind of represents Gen AI, this sort of amalgamation of all of human thought, but without anything new being added to it. And so Carroll represents one of the few avenues they have for ingesting new material, and they seem legitimately excited about that. So I thought that was an important takeaway.
It makes it all the more strange that they want to then force her to become a part of themselves.
Right. Yeah, it's very confusing why they're so obsessed with like bringing everyone on board. It's not clear what that's going to do for them. But again, maybe it's just this biological imperative. They're just being driven to do it without knowing exactly why they have to do it.
it's strange that way because they definitely have the cognition, right?
Yes.
And,
yeah.
You know, famously, a lot of art and literature and whatnot is, you know, human beings grappling with biological imperatives, and that because we have cognition, we don't necessarily need to listen to those things. But here we have all of the wisdom of the human race put together into one big blob of people, and they're like, oh, you know, we've got this urge, so we're going to go do this thing. They do seem very childlike to me. So maybe if we see them in season two grow up a little bit, maybe they'll grapple with this themselves. I'm also very curious to see in future seasons whether there are going to be some people who are only partially connected to this group, or, you know, where there's variations.
I really hope they find a way to dehive some, at least some of them. Mm. We got the impression in season one that it was possible, but Carol and Manusus don't know how to do it yet. But that would be very interesting to see, talk to somebody who was in the hive and then came back. Like, what was that experience like? Because, yeah, you mentioned they seem really childlike, but so it's like an amalgamation of who they were, but then there's something else, right? Because 7 billion mostly adults would not act this way.
Yeah, they would know better. And Zosia, stay away from Faraday cages.
Why?
I don't know. Like, if it's like radio, you know, that might cut you
that's
off.
That's right. That's right. Fortunately, not a lot of Faraday cages just pop up in your day-to-day life. So even though this wasn't like intended to be an allegory for generative AI, I think it is a very interesting way to look at the show that way, especially given how sycophantic they are. They're just willing to do anything for Carol.
Oh yeah, someone's got to change that statement that controls the AI, how it responds to humans.
On the other hand, like, there does seem to be some benefits to this approach, right? Like, they're all sharing resources, it's more efficient, they're all working together. Famously, in the Vince Gilligan written X-Files episode, Je Souhaite, when Mulder asks for peace on Earth, they just kill everybody. Because there's no way to have peace on Earth. And yet, here he is, decades later, finding a way to have peace on Earth just by making everyone an automaton, which is perhaps not a great solution either.
Yeah, like, what would you do with happiness if you found it, right? And that you actually achieved that state. It strikes me as more to life than that. And they haven't figured it out yet.
As you said, we just adapt to it, and then we're unhappy again.
Well, yes, we do, but they don't.
That's true. So what's different about them? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out next season.
Always nice when you anticipate more.
All right, should we move on to our ratings?
Let's.
Okay, so this is the portion of the show where we rank the series in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how does it hold up over time. So let's start with scientific accuracy. What did you rank this, John?
So I felt like putting this one right down the middle. I think the big things are fun and they beg really fun moral questions to play around with, but the science kind of falls apart. At the same time, all the little components of it, those are done well. You know, I kind of see this one as a combination of black and white, and so I put that right down the middle.
Okay. I gave it a slightly higher ranking of 4. I agree the big ideas are questionable and incorrect, but I think by including all those small correct details, it makes the world more believable. In the end, this is science fiction. It's fiction, right? Mm-hmm. It's never going to be completely scientific accurate. It wouldn't be that interesting. Maybe. So, you know, I will give them a pass there. But it makes the world believable to include all those little tiny details as being correct. So I'm going to give them props for that and rank it as a 4. Okay, how about its influence? Now, this is a rather new show, but maybe we can project into the future.
It's hard to tell here, right? Like, it's very difficult, I think, in the streaming world to understand how something is going to hit, especially given that between seasons, the whole world can change. You know, you mentioned this was not conceived of in any way to have anything to do with AI, and yet it was released into a world where that was an important thing. It has definitely won awards. You know, I don't know how many people have seen it. Some people are really keen to talk about it, but I'm not getting the impression that it's really influencing wider culture too much. So I put this just a little bit down further than mid-range.
Yeah, I gave it more in the range of a 3. It was a very popular show. It's Apple TV's most watched series in platform history, more so than Severance and Ted Lasso. So, I mean, people were watching this. I saw people talking about it on Blue Sky unprompted. So, and you know, it, when you go Googling around for YouTube videos, there's actually quite a few people talking about it and enjoying it. So again, I think it's just a symptom of our streaming world. Everything's so separated, but given all that, I think it did reasonably well for the situation we're in. So I gave it a 3.
It is interesting. It has fallen off of the top 10 in a way that some of the other things on Apple TV seem to have longevity. And I don't know what to make of that. I
guess everyone who wanted to watch it already watched it, maybe?
Maybe that's it. Yeah. Go back and see it double speed.
And then lastly, and this might be more difficult, how does it hold up? Now, it did just come out last fall, so it's rather new. So we're going to have to, again, extrapolate into the future.
Yeah, this one I have a harder time with, right? Because the production values are very high, which usually, you know, is my bellwether for suspecting that something's going to have some longevity. I think that the moral questions it grapples with are interesting. But I don't know, there's something that holds me back from giving it more than a mid-score. I'm not entirely sure what.
I don't know. I think this one, if I were to look into my crystal ball, I think this one will hold up. The production values, as you mentioned, were, for the most part, excellent. The acting was excellent. The story is, you know, I think you can take a lot out of it, perhaps even in different ways that we haven't even thought about yet. It has layers, right? And so I think you can continue to pull stuff from it over time. So I gave it a 4. I'm confident it's gonna hold up well. We'll see how things go with season 2. It sounds like they already contracted for a season 2, so we will see more of Pluribus in the future.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Any final thoughts?
No. I'll hand it over to you to bring us home.
Okay. Well, until next time. Our feelings for you haven't changed, listener, but after everything that's happened, we just need a little space. We'll see you next time.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.